This is Kate Scott Allen of OTCO.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code. This episode is being recorded on May 5th, 2010. And tonight we're talking to Jeffrey Van Gogh and Matt Podwasaki, frequent guest on Herding Code. Tonight we're talking about reactive extensions for JavaScript. Do you guys want to introduce yourselves really quickly?
Sure. I am Matthew Podwasaki, and I work for Microsoft. And that's about all I have to say.
Great.
Jeffrey?
I'm Jeffrey Van Gogh. I also work for Microsoft. I work on the cloud programmability team. And one of the things we built is reactive extensions for JavaScript.
And I helped.
Definitely. Major contributor.
So can you clarify, how exactly did you help?
Was it your idea, Matt?
Absolutely not, no. It was all Jeffrey.
So Matt
was our first tester, and after a while he started contributing as well. He has done some great work on the interop with the other JavaScript libraries like XJS and jQuery.
Yeah, basically my role was to look at the existing APIs and see where would be a good fit, how we would integrate with the existing programming models, and talk to the various teams about how they approach things and how we can complement them.
So can you first explain how reactive extensions for JavaScript fits in with the whole reactive extensions thing at Microsoft?
Sure. So our team has developed reactive extensions for .NET for the last 2 years or so. And it actually came out from the Volta project. For those who don't know the Volta project, it was a experimental Live Labs project to do crazy things on the web using .NET. So we did a couple of things like compiling IL to JavaScript, tier splitting your code automatically. And for the tier splitting thing, we noticed that like it was kind of hard to combine multiple asynchronous tier split API calls. So we started developing an API to make that easier. And from that came reactive extensions. We saw that that was something that was useful in general and not just in the full project. So we started shipping that as a separate component. So we released that in November last year. And then after that, we said, well, this stuff is generally applicable and not just to .NET, so let's build a JavaScript version as well. JavaScript has a lot of asynchronous stuff going on, so it's a perfect fit for reactive extensions.
Yeah, and quite frankly, it was something that was highly needed. If you look at a lot of the asynchronous JavaScript code, you'll have a lot of callbacks, nested callbacks. And what it really doesn't handle a lot of the times properly is the error handling and the unification of that kind of callback model. Some have weird callbacks, some have objects with callbacks inside of them, and so on. And what we wanted to do is kind of simplify that model and say, okay, well, we're going to have a single programmatic model over the entire way of doing JavaScript and callbacks. For example, in jQuery and Ajax, you would have an Ajax with settings objects, and you would have on success and on error and so forth. And instead, what we want to do is be able to pass a URL and then after that subscribe and handle both the success and the failure cases.
Yeah, and then you want to do more complex operation on these things as well. So right now, if you see somebody doing an asynchronous call, combine it with a timeout, people have to build up a state machine to listen to both these events. And that makes your code very complicated. It wraps your code inside out, and it's not immediately obvious what your code is trying to do anymore. So we want to wrap it inside out yet again to make it look like imperative code again so that you can just follow what the application tries to do.
Basically, what the intent is to come up with a more of a unified programming model over asynchronous operations and events, and that's all it comes down to. It.
Okay, so this is kind of like the syntax. You're looking at the events as kind of a stream or a collection, and then you're kind of querying over that event stream.
Yeah, exactly. The idea, what you're thinking of is when you think about link to objects from the .NET world, what you're thinking about is composing over collections. So you're iterating over collections. And the idea behind the reactive extensions is to turn that around and say, well, asynchronous operations and events are kind of the same thing as well. But instead of being a pool model where you call move next, you are having these things pushed to you. So on next, or on error, or on completed, and so forth.
Yeah, and then the extra difference is that there's time involved. So in a collection, you control when the next value comes in by calling on next. And in the reactive extensions, it just happens to be whenever the thing comes in, you have to respond to it.
So that's, I guess, part of, kind of like a mind bender a little bit, because you're querying over something that is asynchronous. So you're saying join these things or bind these things, you know, iterate over these things. But I mean, it may be a while before certain ones come in, right? Because some of these events can be calls to another service or, you know, something like that, right?
Exactly. Yes. But in the end, it doesn't really matter that much, because the query operators are just the same as if you were working on collections. And only at the endpoint, when you subscribe to something, you have to worry about that they come in a longer, it takes a longer time. If you use all our operators, they look exactly the same as working on just regular collections.
I noticed, you know, Matthew, you've kind of taken this up a step from what jQuery did, and you've talked about how this compares to binding. Like the jQuery does allow you to bind to certain things. So, So what exactly are the, you know, differences or benefits above that?
Okay, well, yeah, in jQuery you have such things as bind and unbind, which allows you to hook into DOM events as well as create custom events. They also have such things as live events as well, and so forth, which allows you to attach to not only DOM elements that exist right now, but and those events that you're listening to, but also anyone in the future. Now, what we've done is that we've kind of created a transition layer so that you can go from the bind model and directly over into the reactive extensions model, so that what you can do is you can do some pretty advanced operations such as filtering, aggregation, and so forth, and as well as composing it with other operations such as making another asynchronous JavaScript call or something like that. An AJAX call. So that's primarily what we've added the capabilities to do, is to transition from the model of jQuery into the model of RxJS pretty seamlessly. And not only for the events, but also anything else that could have a callback, such as effects things like fade-ins and fade-outs and so on.
So one example I think that you showed me was the idea of a mouse move, and so that you're able to subscribe to it, but you can kind of put in that filter where you say, I'm interested in mouse move events, but only within this certain area, or, you know, and handle the whole kind of mouse down, mouse up, and that kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah, which is cool. I don't know. Do you want to talk about that?
Sure. It's basically what it comes down to is the fact that you can combine certain events together, such as mouse moves and mouse downs and mouse ups and so on. And what you could do is create sort of things like drag and drop that way, where you can make sure that you can tag the mouse moves with the mouse downs until the mouse up happens. And you can do that rather seamlessly. And those sorts of things are fairly easy to do in the reactive extensions for JavaScript. It's just a series of select many's, or just combining these events together.
Yeah. So yeah, we have all kind of operators in Rx to make that possible. So you can say mouse down, and when that happens, now start listening to mouse move, and you use the select many operator for that. And then if you want to say stop, you can use the until operator. So there's like a lot of operators that take multiple of these event streams and then they do operations on them. So there's things like zip, where you say every time a value from both event streams comes in, fire it out together. There's buffers. You can say only give me a value every three times that an event comes in and group them together. So there's a lot of these advanced combinators.
Yeah. What's really interesting, I mean, for example, zip, what you can do is you can take a stream of mouse moves and then another stream of mouse moves that skips ahead one, and then combine them together to get a kind of a differential between one mouse move and the other. So you have a constant delta stream of the two mouse moves together. And to do that without having this composable nature is kind of difficult. And there are a lot more operators, as Jeffrey said. I mean, for example, you could have these complex things called joins, which I have an example on my blog on how to use those. But it's basically a thing over a join calculus to allow you to say, when this and this happens, then do this. When this and this happens, do this. So it's a way to really combine events and asynchronous operations to create some really, really interesting patterns. One of my favorite ones is AMB, or the ambiguous operator, which says when this or this happens, and when that first thing happens, then always listen for this thing to fire. For example, if I say, okay, I'm listening for the letter X or the letter Z, and then when you press the first one, X or Z, then it'll continue to listen for that one, Z, for example. Any number of those things, it just makes it really, really easy to compose them together.
So I guess one of the things that's a little bit interesting about this is because it's a continual stream, like let's say I had some logic that I said, as long as all the mouse moves are within this area, then do this. And so that's true at the beginning, but over time, the mouse moves out of that area and then that changes. So that just ripples through all that logic then. In other words, if I've already taken control flow, you know, it seems, and I guess this gets into the whole functional nature of this, right?
Sure. So in your sample, if you have an object that represents a mouse move, let's call it mm, you could just write mm.take while, and then you pass in a function that is a predicate that says, well, if it's in this range, and then you return true. And then the moment that predicate doesn't hold anymore, we'll automatically stop listening to the mouse move and send an uncompleted message out. So it's completely composable, and you just pass in the predicate to say what part of the stream you want, and then Rx will take care of the underlying mechanism of unsubscribing to the source stream and sending out the incomplete.
So one of the things I was looking at in kind of preparation, I was looking at reactive programming as a computing concept, and I was reading about like Fran, which I guess is functional reactive animations, and just kind of looking at, you know, other things that are reactive. Are those the same thing? Like, is this a concept that's gone back for a while?
Yeah, so reactive programming is not something that's new. It's just becoming very more and more important nowadays with the internet and a lot of asynchronous computations. So there's a long history there, and we're definitely not the first. So the thing that we think that is novel in Rx is that we have all these rich combinators on top of the observable object that we have. And what we don't see in many other programming models is that they separate the values from the exceptions and the uncompleted. So that makes it really nice to don't have to worry about the error cases yourself. It just falls through from your combinators.
Yeah. I mean, there's another example from a couple of years ago. There was a framework called Flapjacks, and it was a way of doing this, what's called functional reactive programming, which is basically reactive programming with all sorts of functional programming ideas behind it, but it didn't make it that far into production, as far as I know, and it was kind of strange in a way in terms of trying to fit Haskell idioms into JavaScript, and it kind of lacked sometimes a more fluent programming model, which a lot of JavaScript programmers are very used to.
So I'm wondering, what's the overlap of functional and reactive programming? Is reactive programming kind of an extension of functional programming, or are they necessarily, you know, is one necessarily a requirement of the other?
So our team, if you look at it, the developers in our team, we all have a huge background in functional programming. And we use like the mathematical models from functional programming a lot in Rx. One of the things that's very different from if you look at pure functional programming languages is that in pure programming languages, functional programming languages, they often want to get rid of any side effect. So your function should do the same thing anytime you call it. And there shouldn't be any state modified. And in Rx, we completely embrace the fact that you can do side effect. In a language like JavaScript, you can always do some side effect, so you better embrace it. So I think that's a big difference between like the functional programming approach and Rx.
So is Rx something that you would typically use in conjunction with something like jQuery, or a replacement for jQuery, or do they just sort of coexist but don't interoperate?
I would say that that they would cooperate quite nicely, and that was kind of our intent. Why we looked at all the APIs as deeply as we did is to see where we could help the libraries better deal with callback scenarios. So it's easy for us to extend a lot of the objects, like the jQuery object, to say blah 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 dot to observable, and then we try to honor the original intent of a lot of the methods, such as making sure that for an AJAX call, the onNext gets the status message, the response, and the XHR. So all of those things were trying to honor the original intent of a lot of those things. So I think it's never going to be a drop-in replacement for a given framework, but allow you to drop it in and use it with your framework of choice and go as far and as deep as you want with it. And just as well, we've shipped what's in the debug folder, which allows you to look at how we've extended the individual libraries, such as YUI, prototype, and so on, and then give you an idea if you are doing anything with that library and we missed anything. It's pretty easy to add some of those things in after we've given you some kind of guidance on how to do it.
Yeah, I think I agree with Matthew. Like, jQuery does a lot of things, and it does it very well, and so do the other libraries. Our library really just deals with asynchronicity, and we don't want to deal with different browser, different DOM calls, etc. There's plenty of libraries out there to do that, and we just want to integrate with them very well. So you use your library to do all the UI stuff, and then Rx ties into that very smoothly to do your asynchronous.
We had a question over Twitter, which you just pretty much answered, but I want to extend on it. So it was from Detroit Pro on Twitter, and he said, is Reactive Extensions a fork of jQuery or a plugin? And so it obviously is a layer on top of it, but what is the way in which you, so I'm using jQuery is, and then I want to add in Reactive Extensions. Is it a plugin or is it an additional layer, or how exactly do the two interoperate in my application?
So yeah, it works as a plugin. So you just load your jQuery or XJS, then you load rx.js, which gives the primitives, and then you can load rx.jquery.js, which will add to the prototypes of jQuery to add the conversions to Rx.
Exactly. So any number of those conversions, such as to observable, which does the bind and unbind, to live observable, which does the live events, and fade as observable, and fade in as observable, fade out, and so on.
Okay. And so we got another question over Twitter from Sean Chambers, and he asked if there were any constructs or ideas around better organizing or managing of a large JavaScript or jQuery implementation with RxJS. Is that a clear enough question? I guess he's saying, you know, I've got...
Yes, I think I understand. It is in terms of... I think where he's going with that is something like what YUI does in terms of loading scripts based upon when you need them. In terms of, okay, now I think since this operation happened, now I need this script or I need that script, and not necessarily front-loading your browser with all of those scripts ahead of time. And what you can do certainly is use RxJS to load up those libraries. Sure, just as well, you know, jQuery has the same thing that, you know, to be able to load a script. YUI does, and I don't see why we can't support the same thing. Just to on a certain manner to basically scope a script asynchronously.
Yeah, and I think in fact we even have for the YUI script loading, we have the Rx binding for that.
Yes. Yeah. We have that one for most of the libraries that support that. For jQuery, there's load script, and we already have that.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty simple to do a script tag injection into the document, kind of on demand, and load stuff up when you need it. And nice thing is it's non-blocking too, so it doesn't matter if you inject it whenever. One of the questions we had at Alt.net was kind of around that same thing. Was, you know, we end up writing lots of functions, and sometimes we're duplicating code, but it ends up kind of spread all over the place, or it ends up, you know, we write a lot of the same kind of things for event handlers, and then if something changes, we have to go in and change it everywhere. Right. And, you know, I'd kind of talk to him. This was in my session. I posted JavaScript WTF, where people could just ask questions. And so my answers were to, you know, well, look and see how you can generalize functions and use them and call them using apply and call versus, you know, just calling them directly. Yep. If need be. But the other thing that I kind of mentioned was that the reactive extensions would be another way to kind of compose in event handlers or things that you want to happen, like aspects or things like that.
Yeah, you can easily do that because now with Rx, your events just are represented as an object, observable, and you can just write an operator that takes one observable and then produces a new observable from that. So you can use the observable.create operator to write your own functions to do that. And it makes your API very fluent.
So have you guys explored any scenarios, like run some typical scenarios and kind of compare, you know, how much code it would take to do in a jQuery, you know, native jQuery versus using reactive, you know, any sort of that sort of studying?
We did that with the dictionary suggest pattern where you have like a text box and when you type, it will do an Ajax call to find all the completions of the word you're typing and display that in a drop-down list. The code was significantly smaller, like 4x smaller.
Yeah, because what you're trying to do is you're trying to combine together the key up events along with an Ajax event stream, parse the JSON or what have you, parse the XML or whatever the response is, and throttle it appropriately so that you're not bombarding the server with every single little key press, but instead a more throttled key press. And all of that to do that in callback scenarios in other pure libraries is a lot harder to do. Without having to do such things as set timeouts and so on. So that's really some of the differences. And one of my latest blog posts was to take an existing game that someone had written in plain old JavaScript and kind of move it over to jQuery and RxJS and just see what some of the differences are in terms of how you would structure your program. And that you basically have to, you know, deconstruct your logic into smaller reusable chunks, and it becomes a lot easier to understand, especially when you start throwing in combinators like saying, get me the key down event where the key is the left arrow, then do this. And when it's the right arrow, do that. So breaking it down into two different listeners and that sort of thing.
And what's the overhead or the size of the library itself?
So the base library is 23K ungzipped, and gzipped it's about 6K.
Wow.
Right now I think it's a downloadable executable. You install it. Any plans to get that up on the CDN or to kind of push it more?
So right now it's a zip file, actually. The first release was an installer, and the last update we switched to a zip file. We're working with the ASP.NET team to investigate putting it on the CDN as well.
And what's the status of the library? I mean, is it considered experimental? Is it there support? Is it? I mean, what's the sort of life cycle of it?
The license allows you to use it in production. There's no support through product support, unfortunately. But we have a forum, and we are pretty responsive to questions on the forum. We are still releasing every couple of weeks, so you have to assume that we'll break things. But we post a list of breaking changes with every release. So It is in between experimental and a product, I have to say.
Yeah, a lot of the times, mostly it's a lot of the third party integrations that's changing the most. Although, you know, certainly there are things here and there, such as going from params objects to supporting arrays as well, and that sort of thing.
So I noticed recently on your blog, Jeffrey, you'd written about Node.js bindings for RxJS, and that's Node.js has come up a lot recently, just something we've been talking about. And so I wonder if you could talk about what, you know, how that works. And my understanding was Node.js does not run on Windows at this point, right?
That's true. So I was playing with Node.js a couple of weeks back. I was doing that actually on my MacBook, and I saw that like all their APIs are asynchronous, which is pretty cool. But the problem is that all their APIs, pretty much all of them, they return an error object as the first argument. And you have to check every time you get a callback if that error object has a value and then throw. And it got pretty complicated if you want to write a bigger sample in Node. So what I did is I wrote Rx bindings on top of the Node.js APIs. And I was able to write a very elegant web server that did all kind of calls, like making calls to the file system, reading in files asynchronously, and then posting them back to the user without having to worry about all these exception issues, etc.
Yeah, definitely. When you look at the APIs for Node, you'll see a very C influenced API set, and it's not coincidental that that's the case. So, you know, thinking back to the old days of checking for H results or something like that, that's exactly what you have to do.
Which often leads to very beautiful code.
Absolutely.
and then I noticed also you'd written about Script Sharp.
Yes. So a lot of people, especially at Microsoft, are using Script Sharp to generate JavaScript so that they can get their type checking and some just typo checking, etc. So what they often need there is a binding to the library so that you can use the API So you need to have the strong typed version. So we are shipping that one as well. And a nice side effect of that is that we can actually generate a documentation file because we have like all the XML documents in C# now.
Yeah, I've found that when I've been writing a lot of my blog examples, sometimes I'm more able to pull up the CHM, the compiled help, instead of just diving through the code sometimes. I'm like, oh, that's what it is, and go for it. I mean, that's right now the best documentation we have. Outside of my blog, of course.
Well, that is something. I mean, you've been just on a tear. How many have you written? It's like 13, 15, somewhere around there. You've written quite a few.
Yeah, something like that. Basically, I went a while back, and I had been talking with Jeffrey and Eric for quite a while about Rx in general. And when I heard about the JavaScript version, I'm like, ooh, I really want to dig into this. And so I was asking, well, can I talk about this yet? Can I talk about this yet? And then when I finally got the green light from Jeffrey and company, I'm like, okay, let's do this. Let's show what we can do. But the side effect of a lot of the posts that I've done is basically a lot of the code that I've written also applies to the .NET version as well. It's literally a one-for-one transfer outside of a lot of the jQuery integration and so forth. But most of the design patterns that I'm using hold, which is the great thing, is basically that, you know, people can now use the same exact join patterns that I was using. Take that if they understand the differences between, you know, JavaScript functions and C# lambdas. It's not all that hard to squint and see that one looks fairly similar to the other.
Yep, and Matthew actually wrote most of his posts before the RxJS version was even public. So I think it created quite a bit of hype. It was quite nice.
Yeah, I definitely try to create as much interest as I could, and it was definitely interesting when it finally did go live during Mix. We were sitting there just hours beforehand working on some of the samples that Eric was going to show at Mix, so I thought that was kind of both funny and interesting at the same time. But yeah, it basically allowed us to frame the conversation in such a way that say that don't be confused if you already understand what's being done for Rx for .NET. A lot of the knowledge can just transfer over.
Yeah, so that was great that Eric was able to speak at Mix. Hopefully that, you know, raised the awareness quite a bit.
Yeah, and he showed off some of these samples that both Jeffrey and I had written. One was the dictionary suggest, the other one was the Bing Maps and Twitter integration one that I wrote, which is basically every minute or so it'll look for those suckers on Foursquare who like to talk about themselves and where they are, and just put their mug on the map and just show where they are and say what they're talking about.
So that you can rob those people.
Exactly, pretty much. So, you know, it takes voyeurism to a whole new level, and RxJS makes it just that much easier to do it.
And I thought it was also, you know, it was smart of Eric to actually hand out casino chips at a speech. I think that was a good way to, you know, get some interaction going.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I was at one of his talks a month later at the Microsoft event Tech Ready, and he actually used coins, and I got clocked in the head. So what I was determined to do, I gave a talk to a bunch of students at the Imagine Cup US edition, which was held in Washington, D.C., on the reactive extensions. So the Imagine Cup, basically the best and brightest of CS students go and compete internationally for a prize in game development and business development and so on. So they wanted to talk about reactive extensions. I'm like, oh, great, let's do this. So luckily, the week before, we were at JSConf, and they had pirate coins sitting on all of the tables. So I grabbed up as many as I could of those, and subsequently, then the next weekend at the Imagine Cup, I was throwing that at the audience, which is, you know, just little plastic coins that didn't hurt anyone, but still caught people off guard.
So that was my next question, was about JSConf. So both of you went to JSConf and spoke about reactive extensions. What was the subject? What was the reaction? We talked about JSConf on our last show, but we forbade everyone from speaking about it because we knew we were going to be talking to you guys tonight.
So yeah, I gave a presentation in Track B, which is like the 30-minute presentation where you submit your own subject. And People were generally interested. People had to wrap their mind around it. It's a very new concept to most people, of course. But the thing that people really liked was the visualization. So during the presentation, I showed these marble diagrams, as we call them, where we show what like the input stream is and what the output stream generates. And people really found that useful to understand Rx and asynchronous programming in general. So we try to make more of these images available and post them with our documentation in the future so that people can see visually what these operators do. So that was a really good outcome that we need to invest more in that. Other than that, people were surprised that there was somebody from Microsoft actually talking at JSConf. So that was great as well.
That's good stuff.
it was definitely interesting. So Ray, of course, was the good ambassador there. And I'm really glad that he was able to show up and get to interview a lot of people, including Jeffrey and myself. And those videos are out there, as well as stuff on Fuse.js, which is another great library, which is a fork of Prototype, and also interviewed, I think, the YUI guys. So yeah, he was able to do that. It was great to have some presence there. You know, myself, I wasn't really representing any product groups or anything like that. I was mainly there to listen, and I'm really glad I got to drag other people with me to do that and kind of just see where the world was heading with JavaScript and to talk with some of the library designers to see where they thought they were going with the callback models and eventing and so forth. So it was really, really a great time. And the upcoming JSConf EU just opened the registration today. So I highly recommend that people go in and sign up, and not only sign up to attend, but also submit a talk.
At JSConf, you were talking to people about integration and how you would, how you integrate not just jQuery, but other libraries. And what exactly, how difficult is that work to layer, to add reactive extension support to another JavaScript library?
So it's slightly different per library. Most of the patterns are very similar. You want to take the existing pattern and hook up your handler to that, and then use that handler to fire into an observable. Some frameworks require a bit more work than others. So, for instance, YUI, like as it is completely asynchronous in itself in loading, and you have to use like the method to say I need this package to be loaded. So you need to do some more Rx combinators there to hook up to the API itself. So that was an API that was a bit harder to bind to than the others. But in general, it's pretty straightforward. And as Matthew says, we're shipping the source of those bindings with Rx, so you can take a look at the debug folder and see yourself how to do these bindings. And the hard part is digging through all the API and see which of the API are asynchronous, and then it's pretty easy to write the API, the wrapper once you've found it.
Yeah,
but it's just there are so many APIs to go through that every release that we do every couple of weeks, we hope to add more support. And if you see any API that's missing, just send it our way and we'll try to add it for the next release.
Yeah, and basically, what RxJS suffers, many of the other libraries do as well, is lack of documentation. So a lot of the times we're left scratching our head and saying, well, we think it works this way. And so let's write a couple of tests and find out. And sometimes we're right and sometimes we're wrong, but we've learned quite a bit in the process. It was actually interesting at JSConf, one of the major pushes from a lot of the people, including the folks from 280 North, is to talk about unification of how you actually document your JavaScript and publish it.
So we kind of mentioned the script sharp bindings for Rx or JS and everything else. Let you write JavaScript from C sharp. There's Google Web Toolkit. I just today found out there's a GWT style framework for F sharp, which lets you write a web application using F sharp and generate out JS and whatnot. And there's been a lot of do you know what the name of it is, Matt?
Web Sharper. So Adam Granich of IntelliFactory and their group have created Web Sharper. So basically, it's got jQuery bindings and so on and so forth. The reason why, of course, you brought it up is they had a recent interview on the YUI blog, I believe.
So kind of there's been some other tweets from people like Miguel de Acasa and Joe Hewitt of Facebook and Abandoning Apps fame, where he kind of, you know, they kind of rail against JavaScript and the web and the, like, Miguel is going to or wants to start prototyping putting the common language infrastructure, a common language runtime kind of in a browser, so that instead of just using JavaScript, you can use any language that you want that runs on the CLI. And that was kind of what Joe Hewitt proposed too. You know, he's saying that the web APIs are too malnourished or too impotent to be able to write apps as good as, say, iPhone native apps. And so I'm just kind of wondering, you know, what you guys and what other guys on the podcast kind of think about that, and how if that really holds water. And you know, we've got lots of frameworks coming out there that are you know, leveling out the playing field in terms of the DOM. And with the new HTML5 specs coming out, and IE9 finally catching up to the web browser world from 2 years ago, it gets to the point where you can actually start to write true cross-browser code without having to lean so much on a library. Right. You know, in a world where all the browsers have a selector engine, you know, what does jQuery really offer you? Other than, you know, kind of wrappers around different DOM bugs, but reactive kind of is this other layer that isn't really being addressed. But it I'm wondering if you'd see a benefit of putting something like the CLI inside a browser versus, you know, writing more frameworks like reactive that enhance JavaScript and enhance, you know, make the APIs a little bit more robust and composable.
So as I said in the beginning, the Rx comes from the Volta project, and one of the things we did there was compiling IL to JavaScript. So we did a lot of this prototyping a couple of years ago. So you definitely can compile IL to JavaScript. We did that. The question becomes, what of the APIs for .NET do you want to support? .NET has a vast amount of APIs, and it's not 100% sure if all these APIs are applicable to the web. We're still looking into that, but right now we just decided to do Rx as a native JavaScript library. And I must say, it has a nice charm to it. If you look at .NET, like, you have to deal with threads and logs and etc. And in the JavaScript version, we didn't have to do anything like that. So the JavaScript version is actually a lot cleaner than the .NET version. It looks much more elegant, and we can make it much more smaller because of that. So there's trade-offs on both sides. And my experience with developing RxJS, it was not too bad. The web has gotten a lot better in the last couple of years.
Yeah, exactly. I agree that trying to put another band-aid, such as another language, doesn't always sit well with me, especially when you would have to decide what parts of the CLI would work. I mean, certainly IO probably wouldn't, and many of those other things. So it would be kind of arbitrary about what you would do. Instead, I'm seeing a gradual consensus among the JavaScript libraries to kind of standardize on a few things. So the sizzle thing from John Russ about selectors is becoming fairly standard. Those kinds of things. So what I would like to see is kind of some sort of consensus around the callback models, and I think RxJS is a good solution for that. So I think that a lot of that is just because in the past the DOM model was pretty splintered, and there was no real consensus among many of the other libraries on how they were going to approach it. But now that there is more of a consensus, I see less of a need.
And on the other side, the tools for JavaScript are increasing a lot as well. Like, every browser has like decent debugging experience now, something we didn't have a couple years ago. There's a lot of code analysis tools coming out. There's profiling tools coming out. There's code coverage tools, etc. People are developing test frameworks, etc.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
The whole ecosystem is becoming much better.
Exactly. Yeah, the testing stuff. I mean, you could literally write R-spec kind of things. I mean, people are doing some pretty inventive stuff with JavaScript, such as Jake, a rake-style build system for JavaScript. I mean, it's pretty rich what you can do with the language. Just having to deal with the warts of the DOM has primarily been a lot of the people's concerns. And I don't know. I'm pretty happy with the progression of the language in terms of just the community is just outstanding in terms of creating solutions for a lot of these pain points that people have had with JavaScript.
So, and not to sound like too much of a company man, but I've just been this past week, I've been working on this webcam stuff and looking at, you know, we're showing off some JavaScript IntelliSense in Visual Studio. And that's pretty awesome too. I mean, like the way it's dynamically evaluating it and all that. I mean, the tooling is just all around is pretty incredible. Not from, you know, in IDEs all the way down to the libraries.
Agreed. And that's another, you know, point of contention is that so many people have been coddled by the IDE to have them finish every single word that they do. And getting away from that gets people awfully uncomfortable. So now that we have decent IntelliSense, a lot of those fears have also been allayed quite a bit, that you don't have those silly typo errors as much anymore. And having to hit debug or running your test and realizing you failed because you misspelled.
Yeah, it's kind of the point where JavaScript applications are starting to get large enough that the unit testing pays off. Before, you know, you only had like 100, maybe 1,000 lines of JavaScript, so you just hit refresh and you'd see any syntax errors you had immediately. It wasn't that big a deal, but as everything starts to get a little bit more complex, you know, it takes a little bit longer to get to the point where your JavaScript's running. And, you know, it's nice to be able to write the tests. And it's so easy to write tests for JavaScript now compared to if you're able to isolate your code away from the DOM, it's very easy to write JavaScript tests. And I think that's one of the things that kind of galled me the most about this whole, you know, JavaScript isn't good enough. It's like it goes back to the old, you know, if the program crashes on Windows, it's Windows' fault. It's, you know, if the web, you know, web app sucks, then it's JavaScript's fault. Well, it's not JavaScript's fault. It's the DOM's fault. The DOM is broken everywhere. It's a horrible language. CSS is just irretrievably broken. It needs to be scrapped and start over with something new. And you take the DOM out of the equation, you put in something like Node.js, and, you know, you're starting to look at things like a 20-line proxy server. And things like that. And, you know, it would require another 5 or 6 lines to add caching to it. Yep. And, you know, you try to write something like that in C#, and, you know, you're gonna bog down Visual Studio with all the projects.
I heard a podcast, a jQuery podcast, and John Resig said the same thing. He's like, you know, jQuery is not really so much fixing anything other than inconsistencies in the DOM, you know, and if the DOM wasn't so broken, there wouldn't be such a need for jQuery. And, you know, that really kind of made it make a lot more sense that it's really cool that jQuery does all this awesome stuff and works all the way back to IE6. Like, that's just some badass coding to make that all work.
Yep. It's compared to a more static language such as C#, you have to go through such trials and tribulations to create a mock object. Whereas in JavaScript, it's so easy to create a fake or a stub or even redefine a function as to control its side effects than it is to do in C#. And that's what I found more often the case is I'm like, oh, I realize there's going to be a side effect here. Let's redefine this function with a fake value. Boom, go. And it's been incredible for me to kind of step into that world and say, well, it's not as bad as people think it is.
So is there a place where reactive extensions for JavaScript doesn't help anything, you know, where it would be a bad fit?
That's a very good question.
Now, it's just awesome all the time. Okay.
Well, I mean, basically, if you don't have any sort of asynchronous code and you're not doing any sort of eventing, you don't necessarily care that it's, you know, that if something's asynchronous or event based, then fine, don't. That's really where the sweet spot of RxJS is the fact that it's a unified model of event based and asynchronous programming in JavaScript. So if you don't really do anything with that, then it probably wouldn't be a very good fit.
And the other places where we think it is a good fit, I think it's more of a question of which operators don't fit where. Like, certain operators are great, but they are not the best if you have a very, very tight loop. So it's just like any other API. Just be careful when you use what API. Some of the APIs like buffering, well, buffers are expensive. And if you don't have a good policy on your buffer, they're a memory hole. So it's just a matter of deciding which operators use and just use it wisely.
I don't know how much into the technical details we want to get in the podcast, just because it's audio and there's it's kind of hard to show people in the code. But one of the things I was curious about, and I haven't looked at the source in a while, I was wondering how you handled scope, because one of the trickiest things in JavaScript is the way that scope is handled. You don't really have block level scope, and everything's kind of forms a closure, these functions, when you start passing them around. And you do a little bit of hacky black belt stuff in there around, you know, throwing exceptions and catching it. I'm just wondering how you keep track of the scope when you're composing these different functions together that aren't necessarily written. You know, do you have to write your functions differently to work with RxJS, or can you just take kind of any old function and with, you know, this scattered everywhere and not really worry about it?
Yeah, you have to be a bit careful because we have a lot of closures in our API. So especially with the this operator, you have to be careful that, like, once you create a new closure, that the this that you were working on is no longer there. So you often have to assign this to something else. So yes, you have to be very careful with closures, and especially if you come from a .NET background, because closures work very different in most .NET languages than in JavaScript. So in the beginning, I made quite a bit of mistakes by just assuming .NET semantics. But you learn to use the right mechanism. But I think that's mainly for developers of Rx operators that they have to worry about. Once you start using the Rx library, Rx takes care of a lot of things for you. So it's only when you add a new operator or you add a wrapper for another JavaScript eventing library.
So I was looking at the actual code in Reactive Extensions, and there it says that the license is the, what is it, Microsoft Reactive Extensions for JavaScript and .NET Libraries license, which is one that I have not used before. So I wondered if you could kind of clarify exactly what sort of license that is.
Sure. So it's a license that's specifically for Reactive Extensions. And so it's pretty much an as-is license. Use the code as-is. We don't have any product support right now, just because we're still developing this thing actively. But you're free to use it in your current projects. There's, of course, some more legal terms with I'm not a lawyer, so I cannot explain every single detail. But we try to make it as usable as possible. It's currently not an open source license. If you want to do an open source license at Microsoft, it's a lot of work, and we're a small team, so we don't have the resources to go pursue that right now. But we're trying to make it within the boundaries that we can get through as much as we can.
Got it. Okay.
So one of the things I noticed when I look at the Reactive code or examples of using Reactive is the .NET naming conventions that it looks like it uses, you know, Pascal casing instead of camel casing for function names, that sort of stuff. I'm wondering what the rationale is there.
Sure. So we didn't use the .NET naming patterns just to stay with the .NET naming patterns. The reason we do that is because a lot of our operators have names that are the same as JavaScript keywords, like return, finally, throw, catch, while, do, all those operators. And we didn't want to give those different names because they really do to Rx what the JavaScript keywords do in imperative programming. But because JavaScript, these keywords are not context sensitive, we cannot use them for our method names. So because of that, we had to make those capital case, the Pascal case. And as we wanted to keep the library consistent, we had to make everything Pascal case.
Are there any browser restrictions on the library? Any browsers it doesn't work on?
Any browser that runs JavaScript, it should work on. We even run outside the browser, like in Node.js or any console scripting engine that you want to use.
Yeah, Rhino as well runs just fine.
Is there a vision for the final delivery vehicle for this thing? You know, is it going to be rolled into the .NET framework, spun off as an open source project? Are you just not thinking about that yet?
Well, we're thinking about it, but we don't have an answer right now. If you have like a specific preference, of course, you can let us know on the forum or on Twitter, and we'll take that in consideration.
Jeffrey, Matthew, you have anything you want to talk about JavaScript-wise? I just wanted to kind of finish up and ask a few questions on just .NET Reactive Extensions, but...
Just that we're going to have a new release very soon with more bindings to existing JavaScript libraries. And I'm also working on, as I said, making more of these marble diagrams available. So expect more news in that in the near future.
Yeah, so pay attention to the forums and give the team feedback there. Pay attention to Jeffrey's blog and my blog, and we'll probably be cranking out more JavaScript here in the near future.
Awesome. So I already showed my hand there. I wanted to ask about just reactive extensions for .NET, if there's anything new there. There's a reactive extensions library for 3.5 and 4.0.
And Silverlight.
And Silverlight, which is very cool. And actually a very cool use case, right?
Definitely for Silverlight, where you are forced into an asynchronous mode of operation by default. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense that there really isn't a real good unified way of doing asynchronous programming. You either have the begin end model, or you have the event and async class, or you just have a callback. And so there's a good way to unify it and handle the exceptions, cancellation, and so on in a pretty uniform model.
I really wish this had been available. I worked on the March Madness site a while back, and I guess a year ago, and it was really difficult because we had to do all this asynchronous, like you're saying with Silverlight, it's asynchronous, and we had to do a custom ASX parser because there's the ASX file was using some things that were unsupported in JavaScript. So we constant callbacks and checking with ad servers and all this stuff, and so it was just tons of asynchronous programming, and this, you know, there's crazy state machine going on, and this would have made it so much easier, to just be able to say react to events, and just that's it.
Exactly, and then be able to throttle them to do certain actions to finally clean up and to clean up things after you're finished and so on. Yeah, I've been doing some Silverlight work as well, and it's pretty much been the same case as while it's doing the operation, make sure that the busy screen is flashing, and when it's done, finally stop that, clean up all the resources and so on. So it's fairly powerful.
And you know, what you described there is easy enough, but then it's like, well, what if something fails during the loading of resources? You know, still need to do this and still need to clean up, but do we re-query? And if that re-query fails, how many times, just all that kind of stuff. It's like so much, it's just a headache to do state machine kind of things in C#.
Exactly, and then you have all the base combinators that are available to you to do repeats and retries and so on is built right into it.
So we talked about Silverlight there. Is there anything just .NET in general wise with reactive extensions we want to talk about?
So right now for the .NET version, what we're mainly working on is the support for the Windows Mobile 7 phone. So RX will be on the phone by default, so it will be in the ROM. Every phone will ship with it. So phone developers, they don't have to put it as an extra library in the download or anything. They can just start using it right away.
Wow, that's huge. That's really cool.
Yep, so we've been spending a lot of time on that, like making sure that we get documentation, putting the thing in the phone, running on the ARM processor, etc. So that's where we invested most of our time for the .NET version in the last couple of months.
Okay. Well, is there anything you guys want to pimp during the last bit of the show here? Do you want to talk about anything in additional, anywhere you're speaking, anything you're selling or buying or bartering or anything else?
No, I think what we really want to emphasize is that we want people to download it, visit the forums, and be active on the forums, and give us feedback as to what we're doing right, what we're doing wrong. What we really want to do is see how the community is adopting it, if it's adopting it, where they're using it, where they're not, what kind of pain points they have, and where we could ease some of those problems.
Yep, exactly. And just the forum, Twitter, blog, like we monitor all of them. So just give your feedback any of those forums, and we'll try to incorporate it.
Right. If it makes sense, of course, yes.
Yes. I should have asked this very, very much earlier on, but Jeffrey, how big is the team that you're working on?
So our team is 5 devs plus an architect, but on RX, there's only 3 devs working on that. And so that is the .NET versions that are on DevLabs. It's the Windows Mobile 7 version and the JavaScript version. So not a whole lot of people.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive.
But even though our official title is developer, we don't have any testers or PM or release managers. So we do that in addition to coding RX.
And then I help them find bugs as well whenever.
Yeah, Matthew is like our outsourced East Coast tester, developer, evangelist,
MVP. Yeah.
There you go.
Great. Okay. Well, you guys ready for me to wrap up then?
Sure.
Okay. Sure.
All right. Well, thanks a bunch, guys, for coming on the show and talking about reactive extensions with us.
No problem. It was fun.
Yeah. Great. Great to have to be on here again.
All right. That's all the time we have tonight. Thank you very much. Bye.
The one thing I worry about with reactive is that it won't see widespread adoption.
Well,
because
people are
in such a jQuery mindset, the comment you most often hear is, I used to hate JavaScript until jQuery came along. And you're like,
yeah, and now I can use jQuery to add two numbers together.
You yeah. saw that, right? On Stack.
Yes.
That was just beautiful.
Yeah. Yes. But I mean, yeah, that's always a question. You know, Elijah Manor was one of the ones who said, you know, what's the value proposition here? Well, try to compose events together really in jQuery just doesn't really happen. Especially to handle a unified way of handling errors in that, it doesn't really happen. All other AJAX calls are kind of wonky in terms of most only support the on success, and then some failure will cause something really bad to happen. So we went into there and kind of fixed the plumbing a little bit to handle the errors a little bit more gracefully. So any number of those things, we felt there's a definite need for it, because reactive programming without it is a lot harder, especially to do compositional behavior. Even with jQuery, I mean, jQuery is what is a patch over the DOM, really.
Mm-hmm.
It is not a patch over events necessarily, and it's not a patch over asynchronous programming. It is to a point with the JSON parsing and so on, but it is not a complete patch.
Well, and the eventing stuff, the best it does is it normalizes the event model, which is good, but it's still a patch over the DOM stuff.
Absolutely, because then you don't have to say, oh, is E and E dot event is not null, then,
right.
Well, it must be IE, therefore.
It finally made it safe to program JavaScript, because you could program to one model instead of, you know.
That's at least, right. Yeah, as far as events go, yeah.
Yeah, it was a patch over the event class itself, which was highly needed because of all the wonky things. I mean, still, you have to worry about some of it, but for the most part, they solved a lot of that for you. Now, if you throw a composition layer on top of that, that's where we see the real value.
Yeah, most of the jQuery stuff I see. I mean, it's good. It's a great library. I use it almost on every project. But, you know, they say it's easier to write JavaScript because, yeah, they throw out the error handling. They throw out, you know, composition. They just go to chained procedural programming, basically.
Yeah, procedural functional programming, although you could say that jQuery is a monad and go down that path. But no, I mean, when you're doing lots of jQuery, you're still typing lots and lots of dollar signs, but you're not necessarily solving a lot of the compositional behaviors that's really required for JavaScript as a non-blocking way of programming. You know, because for a lot of the stuff, you shouldn't be blocking.
And people don't realize this, but every time you type a dollar sign, you new up a new instance.
Yep. Yeah. So that's why people, there was that eight shortcuts recently posted, the eight shortcuts of of jQuery. And that was to use the word jQuery and not the dollar sign, and to sometimes use root.delegate instead of live events. I mean, there are a lot of really good tips in there. And I think, think that we need to address some of that in RxJS as well, as just in terms of how we're addressing it as well. And I think for the most part, I think we got that, right, Jeffrey?
Yeah. We need to add support for that root delegate, but that's easy to add for the next release.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. One of the things I was looking at on the jQuery patches. So one of the things I usually tell people is that jQuery accepts an extra parameter, which is a scope. So when you're doing the selector searches, you only look, you know, from this element and its child nodes instead of doing an entire document scan.
Right.
And I'm wondering if, like, your selects and wheres take that into account on the, specifically when interacting with jQuery. If it's able to say, okay, you know, let's scope this. You know, so if you say...
Yeah, if you're doing a scoped, so you go blah, blah, some selector dot click or something
or
like that.
No, so you do some selector, comma... you know, some other selector or some get element by ID, a div, and say you just want to, let's take your mouse over example, where you're only wanting to get left or right button clicks and do different things.
Okay.
So you could either bind that to the entire document and capture, you know, all all mouse clicks anywhere, or you could say just within this region, you know, and do that using a jQuery selector. And I'm wondering if you take that into account when you do your selects and wheres and
I mean, absolutely. I mean, basically what we're doing is we are abstracting over their bind syntax, quite frankly, which click and every other event handler in jQuery is.
You would just use your jQuery selector, so you like $ and then your query, and then on that result object you would say dot to observable click. So you would first use the jQuery selector, and then only on those elements that you've selected, we hook up the click event.
Oh, so you glom onto the context, the jQuery context.
Yes.
So yeah, you can use your scope object there as well.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yep.
Cool.
Yeah, and then you can say like the, you know, inside of there you can say like event dot target or something like that, and hook into the target and do whatever you need to do there as well. So yeah, I mean, basically, yeah, wherever possible for each of the libraries, not only jQuery, but all the other ones where it's possible, we hook right into their root object as well, and try to do the same thing, is try to live and breathe like them, but still be different.
Yeah, yeah, that's crucial, because when you start binding events to, you know, just like input selectors will kill your performance on a page. And if you're trying to bind events to them using jQuery or anything else, it kills you if you try to bind to, like say you've got a grid control, because everyone loves those.
And absolutely.
If you got 100 rows, 5 columns, and grid and inputs and all of them, you'll start to see, you know, your browser will get a frame rate as you move the mouse around. If you're binding to events and checking things like mouse move or click and stuff like that. And so being able to scope things to local, you know, like we used to only capture mouse enter, mouse leaves on rows, and then we would dynamically set event handlers to the inputs just on the row where the mouse cursor was, because if we did it for everything and then destroy them afterwards, because if we did it to everything, it would just kill.
Yeah, I mean, and that's another great point though to RxJS is the fact that the subscribe and unsubscribe model is completely identical. In that when you call subscribe, it hands you back a disposable handler that at any time when you're finished listening, you call dot dispose. So you don't have to remember to do blah 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 dot unbind and hope that you have the same one or the same amount of them there. It's you've got a handler. You can now dispose of it cleanly and safely.
Yep.
So that in itself is huge. And we ship the actual samples, not only the debug way of dealing with those libraries, but also we have a quick sample of showing you how we hook and unhook examples. So that's the really cool part is so we have three buttons. We have a button that activates the other button, and then the other button that deactivates that button and changes the text of it. So we're showing you how to activate and deactivate using RxJS with that native library.
I'm still recording, and this has been very interesting. And I just added K. Scott Allen because he just showed up. So,
inconceivable.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right, let's start over.
Yeah, we can. Hey.
Tell me a little bit about the reactive extensions.
Not so much. Anyways,
they're not so much proactive.
Exactly. We are not predicting what you're going to do. What events Although you're going that, to call that, ahead of time.
That would be an awesome framework. The proactive framework. Let me just wire up these things. It looks like you want to.
Yes.
It's the Clippy environment of it looks like That's you right. open an IDE. Therefore, I think we need to hook up all of these events for you.
That's VS 2012, right?
Right.
Absolutely. But for some of the stuff that we've been talking about here, you could easily fold back into and replacing some of the other stuff that we talked about. Unfortunately, it's been me doing most of the talking, and Jeffrey's been kind of left out in the cold here.
No problem.
I don't know what else. So, we talked about everything. I don't know if you have any interest. If you have any questions you've been wondering about, we can see if we've covered them or not. Okay, Scott?
I was kind of curious what sort of how you selected the style that this API was going to assume.
So what kind of style? You mean the naming or like fluency?
Right, just
or
like the naming conventions and how it was going to act. Just because there's so many various styles to JavaScript. Some people color it with a CLR flavor, and some people take more of a what I'd call like the jQuery approach, jQuery style API.
Yeah, so as I already said earlier in the interview, the casing is based on just the fact that we would collide with JavaScript keywords otherwise. So that's why we had to do scale casing. So the rest of the API is like there's a lot of API names that are based on link in .NET just because that's the one that we started with. So it makes sense to use the same naming. And then for a whole bunch of operators that are not in link but then have a functional background, we just use the names that are used in the functional programming world. So like AMP, that's an operator that's been defined in like 1965. So we just kept that API that way.
Excellent.
So you deferred to something going back to 1965. I think that makes sense.
Yep.
If only we could roll back to Smalltalk, we'd all be happier.
Nah, Lisp. I mean, after all, McCarthy's ambiguous operator came from Lisp. I mean, weren't we just happier in 1958? I think so.
I was. I was a sperm.
All right. Any...
Wow.
Well, I have to sign off now. Sorry.
And on that note, okay. Well, should we wrap up there? Anything else?
You're not going to beat that. Just awkwardly end now.
All right.
No, but there's so many choice editing opportunities with that one.
Yeah. It can go in every show. Okay. Well, thank you so much for showing up at the last minute, Kay Scott.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
Okay. Well, good night, guys. Thank you very much. This was really cool.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Good night again.
Good night.
Good night. Bye.